From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in the opening hour of Forum, we'll check in with Caltrans spokesman Bart Ney about what's going on with the bridge. It has reopened, the Bay Bridge has, 7 o'clock this morning. And today is the last day to file comments for U.S. District Court Judge Denny Chin in the upcoming decision of whether or not to approve a complex settlement reached between Google and representatives of a number of authors and publishers in a class action case. Google says that the deal would serve the public by giving new life to out-of-print books, making them available online for preview and purchase. If the deal goes forward, it could mean the world's books, in effect, would be digitalized under Google in what would make for a vast online library under Google's control. Many are opposed. The agreement raises questions about pricing and privacy and access, and we'll talk about it in the hour ahead. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. We're going to talk about a big case involving Google and, just about everybody else who's ever published a book or read a book or wants to read a book. But before we do that, we're going to go to Bart Ney, who is at the Nimitz Mansion over on Yerba Buena and is, of course, the spokesperson for Caltrans. And welcome, Bart Ney. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, things are running pretty smoothly from all appearances. Now the Bay Bridge opened at 7 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, traffic's running well on the structure now, and we're just glad to have it back in public service.
Was there the sense that you might have had this thing done because all those extra boats and trains and bar trains and buses are out there? The expectation was that the bridge was going to be closed all day today.
Yeah, that's right. Last night, when we were in the middle of doing a fix on an I-bar that came up unrelated to the work that was going to happen on the Labor Day weekend, It looked pretty clear that we wouldn't be able to make it on time. We had to fabricate an extra piece. It had to be tested. There was a number of things that had to happen perfectly to even come close. So it was incumbent on us to let the Bay Area motorists know that the bridge was probably not going to be available.
And things are, shall we say, fixed to the point now where there should be no concern, or are there other things that we should be concerned about?
No, things are fixed related to that crack for sure. We did a full inspection on the entire bridge. That was the only thing that we found, and we were able to repair it. We wouldn't open the bridge if there was any concern at all.
So the expectation is now continued things running smoothly, and at least for the foreseeable future, no more repairs.
Yeah, for the foreseeable future, we don't have repair scheduled. Well, obviously, we have a massive seismic retrofit job that we're doing where we're going to open up a new bridge.
But that's all to come. At this point, we're open for business, so to speak.
Yes, we are open for business. Traffic is running across the structure right now, and things are going well.
Good news. Bart Ney from Caltrans, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
And we're going to talk about this, case that involves Google, and like I said, all of you who are readers or who are interested in buying books, publishers, authors. The Department of Justice has opened up an antitrust investigation into the agreement rights to commercialize digital copies of millions of books. It was a deal that went down in October with Google and the Authors Guild and the Association of American Publishers, and it calls for Google to pay $125 million to create a book rights registry where authors and publishers can register works and receive compensation from book sales or industrial subscriptions. Google would offer the scanned books for browsing and take a revenue cut. And the deadline, by the way, for filing comments is today. Actually, it's 10 o'clock Eastern time. And for authors to object is this Friday, with a court hearing scheduled for October the 7th. The court of public opinion is important in this case, and both sides are vying for public support. Google argues that the deal would serve the public by providing new life to out-of-print books, making them available online for preview and purchase. Opponents say the deal undermines competition by extending to Google de facto exclusivity to become a monopoly. And supporters behind Google include Sony, the American Association for People with Disabilities, the European Commission, and the estate of children's author Dr. Seuss. In opposition are Amazon, Yahoo, Microsoft, the American Society of Journalists and Authors, the National Writers Union, the country of Germany, and the estate of the writer Philip K. Dick. So as you can tell, there are a lot of interested parties in this, to put it mildly. In this forum hour, we want to focus on the digitalization battle of the books. Let me tell you who's joining us. Here in studio, Edward Hasbrook is a writer. He's author of The Principal Practical Nomad, and also co-chair of the Books Division for the National Writers Union. They oppose the Google Book Settlement. Welcome. Good morning.
Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. Tom Krasny, also with us in studio, is a staff writer for CNET.com. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
And we'll say good morning to Pamela Samuelson, who is a professor at UC Berkeley School of Law, joins us by ISDN line from UC Berkeley campus. Welcome, Pamela Samuelson.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have James Glick, who is a member of the board of directors of the Authors Guild, well-known author of books like Chaos and Isaac Newton, and brother of the Waterman. We all know Peter Glick. James Glick, good to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Glad to have you all here. And I thought I'd begin, Tom Krasit, with you so we can get a picture from, well, the CNET reporter who's been following this and following it pretty carefully and quite well, I might add. Google, well, we're talking about so many things here. Initially, we were talking about privacy, and I noticed the Electronic Frontier Foundation even got into the act. But Google has announced a detailed privacy policy in a blog post, so they're covering themselves at least on that. Tell us about that to start out with.
Well, what they did was they actually announced more details regarding their privacy policy that they'll put in place for this project, but they haven't announced everything yet. And they've been pretty consistent all along in saying that they don't release privacy policies until the product is complete. And so they've said, well, we can't give you all the details of how we'll protect information under this deal until we finish the product, and we can't finish the product until the settlement is approved. And so therefore, they were sort of out in the open there, a lot of these details. And so that was very unsettling to a lot of people, that these details were not explicitly covered in the settlement agreement. And so I think you saw them last week come out with a few more details, trying to get people to, you know, at least trying to show that at least they have a commitment to keeping privacy.
Are we also missing details on things like pricing and access and competition? At least that's what the opponents are saying.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of these things are up in the air, and I think that's why a lot of the opposition to the settlement has been pretty heated. The document itself, the settlement agreement, doesn't explicitly cover a lot of these things that people want to know. And you know, Google is basically asking the people as a party to the settlement to trust them that they're going to do the right thing. And that's, you know, not always an easy thing for people to do.
But they're monetizing potentially millions of books, and it would mean that they would probably set the prices, the terms, the conditions for book search commercial services, right?
Yes. I mean, that's the institutional subscription. I mean, there's several parts of this that you have to think about. I mean, there's, you know, authors will have their books digitized and available through a number of different ways. You can have a full copy up there on the book search. You can have just a limited preview. You can have just a little snippet of your book so it can be searched and discovered. Or you can say you don't want the whole thing on there at all. And then you can set the price for that book, you and your publisher or whoever the rights holder is, or you can let Google do it through this crazy algorithm they've developed that'll supposedly pick the perfect price for your book or something like that.
But it's still such a mess. We were talking a little bit about this, you and I, before we went on the air. Jeff Nunberg did an article about this in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he said it's a nightmare for scholars. I mean, you've got Leaves of Grass classified under plant and sod retailers. I mean, you've got some things that it would be funny if it weren't for the fact that all this metadata is just a mess. Madame Bovary by Henry James, a book on the internet by Freud. I mean, some of the stuff is comical.
Yeah, nothing is really useful as a search tool unless it has the correct data in it. So, you know, in addition to all of these other issues that we have to wade through, there's the whole quality issue as well, and Google has some work to do there.
They've also got a head start. I mean, nobody could catch up with them, right?
No, it'd be very hard. I mean, Microsoft was doing this for a while and gave up, you know, once they saw that Google was, going headlong into this project. So, you know, I think it costs, they estimated around $30 a book to scan books. And so we're looking at what? I think there's 23 million books in the world catalog or something like that. So do the math.
And we should mention the deadline was 10 a.m. Eastern time today for comments for Judge Denny Chin. This is the disability folks are supporting this and supporting it very strongly. In fact, this is supposed to be good for, Google is saying, the disabled, students, and minorities, although I was struck by something Christopher Buckley said, the author who's been on this program a couple of times, who opted out because he said whenever capitalists are saying they're doing something for good, I should look at my wallet. But let's talk about why is it good for the disabled, for example?
Well, they had a press conference last week, a number of disabled groups, and I believe it was the National Federation for the Blind spokesman said that this deal would essentially give blind people and people with disabilities access to more works than they've ever had at any point in human history. And so that's an amazing thing to think about, you know, the fact that a lot of these books could be made available, excuse me, in copies that could be accessible by people who are print disabled, I guess the word is. So, I mean, that's an amazing thing. And I think even the opponents of the deal would agree that this project in general, you know, will do amazing things for literature and the study of many things.
Tom Krasit again, a staff writer for CNET.com. Let me go to New York and bring James Glick in, a member of the board of directors with the Authors Guild, author of Chaos and Isaac Newton. And actually, James, you filed the original class action suit, or you were involved in that filing, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. The Authors Guild sued Google about 4 years ago. By way of background, this whole thing started when Google began scanning books by agreements with some of the great American libraries, and they started by scanning books that were old enough to be in the public domain, including, well, you mentioned Leaves of Grass and Madame Bovary, I suppose, in its earlier English translations. And they also started scanning new books, not from libraries, but by agreements with publishers. So at that point, there's no controversy. If publishers, with the consent of the authors or under whatever arrangements they have, wanted to let Google digitize their books the way Amazon was digitizing some of their books, that was all fine. And the public domain books are available to everybody who's willing to spend the money to digitize them, so that was all fine. But then Google started digitizing books that were still protected by copyright, without getting permission from the rights holders. And that was the point when the Authors Guild began a class action suit against Google. And a number of publishers independently also filed individual lawsuits against Google. So this settlement agreement that there's been so much confusion about is the outcome of years of negotiation. And it's in some ways a compromise, but where compromises of this kind are often sort of bad for everybody, everybody gives up a little bit, my view is that this is a compromise that has worked out to be in everyone's benefit. It's nice for Google. It's really good for authors because authors retain control over the use of their works and share in any revenues that might be flowing. And it's fabulous for readers.
Yeah, what about the orphan authors, the authors who can't be identified? They're sort of left in the cold on this, aren't they?
Well, they're unidentified. There's a little bit of mythology about orphan authors. First of all, by definition, there's almost no such thing as an orphan author. An orphan work, people use that term to talk about works that are technically under copyright, but in reality, when you start to look for the copyright holder, you can't find them. This is a problem with photographs. You know, you find a photograph that is still under copyright, but it's not identified in any way. With books, it's less of a problem because they're published with a lot of identifying information about the publisher and the author, and the copyrights tend to be registered. But people die, and so there is such a thing as an old book that's technically protected by copyright, and nobody can track down the owner. But there's no orphan author there because first of all, in this case, the book, by definition, has no commercial value. Nobody's using it. And the author, by definition, can't be found. So I don't think it's really a very big problem.
So as you see, it's good for Google, it's great for authors, great for readers, and it's not a monopoly?
No, it's not. It's nothing like a monopoly. First of all, if you're talking about books in general, digital books, electronic books, at the moment, the marketplace is, I wouldn't say monopolized, but certainly more than 50% controlled by one company, and that's Amazon with its Kindle. There are a lot of other players. Google is not really a player at all. People talk about Google having a sort of monopoly in the future, if the thing is approved, over this class of books that are out of print, because other people won't be using them yet. But at the moment, there's no market for those books. Those books are by definition out of commercial life. And what's happening here, which is so wonderful for everyone, is that these books are being returned from limbo and becoming available, not just, you mentioned, the disabled, but to every American in reach of a computer terminal who right now can't find these out-of-print books unless they have access to a great university library and a lot of time on their hands. Now everybody is going to be able to find these books and start to use them. Yes, If it goes really well, Google will have a tremendous head start. And if it becomes some kind of commercial success, it'll take time for other people to catch up. But all of the rights that Google is granted under the settlement are non-exclusive.
James Glick, again with us from New York, is a member of the Board of Directors of the Authors Guild, author of such books as Chaos and Isaac Newton, and Edward Hasbrook's here in studio. He's a writer, author of The Practical Nomad, also co-chairs the books division for the National Writers Union, and they opposed the Google book settlement. You actually, as an author, opted out because you felt it was too risky. Huh?
Well, you know, James was saying that authors under this settlement, if it's approved, would retain control of their works. But that's true if and only if, not under their existing contracts, but under new definitions in the settlement and under new procedures controlled by a new registry entity which has yet to be created and which ultimately will rely on binding arbitration, not litigation under existing contracts. Only if through those procedures can an author show that they have exclusive rights will they be given any control of their book at all under this settlement. And particularly authors who have more complex or nuanced contractual terms for electronic rights will find out to their chagrin that they may well be deemed to have no control at all over what their publisher does with their book.
So if authors are in the dark or they don't know, they're screwed.
Yeah, the deadline actually was last Friday. So an author who did not know about this or who did not believe that they were affected, who has not done anything yet, if this settlement is approved, will be considered to have irrevocably consented to binding arbitration, not just with Google, but with their own publisher, as well as to the substitution for many of the terms of their existing contract with their publisher of a new set of definitions of rights ownership and revenue split defined by the terms of this inscrutable 500 pages of legalese in the settlement.
And you think it is a monopoly of digitalized books by Google?
Well, the only way that anyone else could obtain the right, you can't negotiate with rights holders who can't be found by definition, and they couldn't have brought this suit either, which is why it's completely inappropriate. Their claims weren't and couldn't have been presented in this suit. And in the guise of a settlement of a lawsuit about by known copyright holders with Google, publishers have very cleverly used this to arrange – Google has cleverly used this to get a license to books whose rights holders hadn't been found and where they couldn't have gotten that right any other way. And publishers have used the guise of this dispute with Google to bring about a massive transfer of rights and control from authors to print publishers.
Congress should get involved?
Well, I think the orphan works problem is clearly one for Congress. The National Writers Union, which filed a brief this morning with the American Society of Journalists and Authors and a group of individual authors objecting to the settlement, has been involved and continues to be in calling for Congress to enact legislation to address that issue and bring these works to people. You know, authors typically are much more interested than publishers in bringing their works, particularly the long tail of out-of-print works, to the public. You know, the print publishers are generally interested in the next bestseller. And that's fine if you write bestsellers, but for the vast majority of authors who don't, what that leaves them is it's the authors who've mostly been taking the initiative to try to make their older works available online or in other ways as ebooks. I was just talking last week with a fellow writer who's been fighting his publisher who isn't allowed to make his own writing available on his own website because his publisher refuses on principle to sell him back the rights and is using the existence of a very hard-to-find and poorly formatted ebook as an excuse for not allowing him to get those rights back. But Google has waded in this case, to a long-standing, continuing, and vigorously litigated set of disputes between authors and print publishers as to who owns the electronic rights to their work. And you know, we can anticipate from that history what's going to happen. Consistently, publishers who in years past didn't really care about anything that wasn't last year's or this year's bestseller. When opportunities came along for digitization, publishers have simply ignored the fact that they'd never bought the electronic rights and have simply gone ahead and claimed them and started selling them to third parties. You know, that's what the New York Times did. Authors, including the then president of the National Writers Union, took them to the Supreme Court and won. Major publishers Random House tried to prevent authors from bringing out ebook editions of their books and lost. The same day that this Google case will be heard in federal district court in New York, a case will be heard in the Supreme Court involving some of the same parties, even some of the same lead lawyers, in which authors and print publishers are disputing who owns rights that print publishers claimed to newspaper and magazine articles. So I think what I would anticipate is that publishers are simply going to claim the entirety of their catalogs, and most authors will get anything under this settlement if and only if they are successful in taking their publishers to arbitration. And publishers will allow books to be made available through this settlement if and only if the settlement gives them a better deal than the existing contracts that their writers have arduously negotiated with them all these years. And that's unfair.
Let me bring Pamela Samuelson into this, who is professor at UC Berkeley School of Law. In fact, UC Berkeley faculty, I believe. Professor Samuelson has already gone on record as being opposed. I don't know if that includes you over Bolt Hall, but the fact is that we've got kind of a copyright mess here, don't we?
Yes, that is it is the biggest copyright mess I've seen in my lifetime. So I have two kinds of objections to the settlement. One is an objection as an academic author. A second set of objections, which we haven't kind of highlighted here yet, is sort of an objection from my standpoint as a legal scholar. So the initial lawsuit was about whether or not scanning books for the purpose of indexing them and making little snippets available was fair use or not. And the Authors Guild and some of its individual members thought that that was not fair use. I have just submitted a letter on behalf of 60 academic authors to Judge Chin, basically saying that most academic authors, we think, would consider the scanning to index and make snippets available as a fair use. So I think that this is a misuse of the class action process, right? It started out about one set of issues with a fairly narrowly defined class, and then the class over the course of negotiations has been expanded to essentially all copyright owners in the world. And it's using the kind of legal jujitsu of a class action settlement to essentially restructure the market for books and to make decisions that really are the sorts of decisions that Congress should be making about author-publisher splits of royalties, about things about how much display a book's out of print should be.
Hold that thought, Professor Samuelson, if you will, because we're coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number and invite listeners to join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and according to linguist Jeff Nunberg, Google's book search is well on its way to becoming, quote, the world's largest digital library, but not without controversy. Today, again, was the last day for comments to be filed with the U.S. District Court on a class action lawsuit between Google and several authors and publishers, and Google has reached a settlement with these industry partners, hopes to build its online library as a service to the public good, but opponents of the deal claim it gives Google a monopoly over digitized books, and we're discussing the settlement, what it means for authors and readers. You are welcome to join in the conversation or to bring any questions or comments to the fore here. Our toll-free number available to you is 866-733-6786. Our lines are open, and you can also join us by email. Our email address, forum at kqed.org. CNET.org. Tom Krasadin is in studio with us, a staff writer for CNET, and Edward Hasbrook, with the co-chair of the Books Division of the National Writers Union and author of The Practical Nomad. He opposes the Google settlement. James Glick, with us from New York, is in favor of it and supports it, member of the board of directors of the Authors Guild and author of Chaos and Isaac Newton. And we were talking to Pamela Samuelson, professor at UC Berkeley School of Law, when suddenly the clock caught us there. And Professor Samuelson, I wanted to get you on record here in terms of, well, first of all, finishing the thought. I'm sorry to have to interrupt you there because the clock caught us. But I also wanted to ask you if we're talking about a monopoly here, as you see it, or why we're not talking about a monopoly.
I think we are talking about a monopoly, and this is related to this issue about the class action settlement. Essentially, what Google is getting is a license from all owners of all copyrights in the world by settling this lawsuit. This is a license that no one else can get unless they start scanning books and essentially get the same kind of lawsuit brought against them and then have the good fortune to settle on exactly the same terms. And that seems extremely risky. I think Google had a good fair use defense going in. But if this lawsuit settles, then the next person that wants to make a fair use claim, I think, is in a much more difficult situation. It's a much riskier kind of thing. And so I think that this is a de facto monopoly, notwithstanding all the language about how it's non-exclusive. Other people can essentially license the books that are in print from their publishers and maybe get a license from the registry for books that have been registered. But no one else can get a license to all the books except Google through this class action.
It makes it non-competitive, essentially, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's really related to the main concerns that I have. The letter that I submitted to the judge on behalf of approximately 60 academic authors was saying that there are lots of benefits that would come with a settlement, but a number of terms really should be modified for it to really achieve the consequence of representing all authors and not just the members of the Authors Guild. I think that more books that have actually been scanned from the major research libraries are books by academic authors, and I don't think the Authors Guild adequately represented the interests of academic authors in the course of the settlement. And one way that I think that's true is that there are no meaningful limits on prices of institutional subscriptions under the settlement. And our letter suggests a number of different kinds of ways in which price gouging could be prevented. But right now, I think that there are not that many limits. And for those of us who are academic authors, we would value broader public dissemination over maximization of profits. And I don't see anything in the agreement to prevent price gouging, and that's my biggest concern.
I would also raise the concern that Jeffrey Numberg raised in his article in the Chronicle of Higher Education about a disaster for scholars, because when you've got all these misclassifications, when you've got, for example, Bob Dylan's biography, Stephen King and Raymond Chandler all listed as 1899, you know you've got problems. Or Moby Dick as a book about computers, also known as The White Wall rather than The White Whale. I mean, there are things in here, like I say, that are almost screamingly funny. But to scholars, those kinds of things are not funny. Let me get our callers in here, though, and we'll begin, Pam, with you from San Diego. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. In tangent what you're saying, I'm taking a break right now from doing my freelance book indexing work. I do it through intellectual analysis. I wanted to ask, because there's a discussion online amongst indexers, I presume that the Google indexing is through algorithms and not by human intellectual analysis. But we are also worried and wanted to ask your experts about what this means for those of us who do index books based on intellectual analysis.
Human intellectual, right, as opposed to robotic or otherwise. Yeah, Tom Krasin?
Well, I believe that they are using a combination. I mean, some of the metadata that you referred to as being so out of whack, I mean, that was entered by by humans to a certain extent, but then Google is also Google, and you know, they do elk. You can't index a project that large without involving algorithms to some degree. I'm not exactly sure.
You didn't know that Mae West's biography was a book about religion, for example, did you?
I mean, I'm not exactly sure the extent or the balance that Google has chosen between, you know, the human input curated data kind of thing and the algorithm, and that's a good question for them that I will be following up with them shortly. But yeah, I think you bring up a good issue.
There's also an issue, I might add, of the rights to the index, which is independently copyrightable. Authors of indexes, which may be among the more valuable pieces of a book for some of these purposes, are like other contributors of portions of a book, short story writers in anthologies, poets. Under the settlement, if you make a claim, you might get some share, if the publisher chooses to give it to you, of no more than $15 per index. But you'd have no control. And for an index, that may not matter so much, although the value may or may not be appropriate. But it's really bad for, say, a short story writer whose story may be worth much more than $15 for inclusion for an anthology, but who under the settlement gets only a one-time fee and has no control over whether the author or publisher of the book in which it's included puts it on the market through Google in this way. And that's why short story writers have been some of the strongest objectors to this
proposal. Understandably so. Oh, yeah. Monica, let's bring you in. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling. This is a question directed toward panelist Samuelson. I'm from Berkeley, California, and I'm currently an undergrad at the university. And for one of my classes, the majority of the books that I'm reading, I can find on Google Books. And this has saved me over $100. So I'm just thinking, wouldn't this be a great way for students especially to access books that they need to read in text? And I just was wondering your opinion on that.
Okay. Pamela Samuelson.
So I've said positive things about Google Books. I use it too. And so the problem is not that Google Books doesn't offer us some very valuable access to public domain books right now and to books whose rights holders have agreed to it. My letter doesn't ask the judge to deny or reject the settlement altogether, but to say there are still some things that need to be dealt with. And so I'm asking him to condition his approval of the settlement on addressing some of the issues, which I think in the long run will really matter to people like you too.
James Glick, let me bring you back in the conversation. You've heard the concerns from Pamela Samuelson and Edward Hasbrook voiced here this morning, and you say essentially what to those kind of concerns, which are real concerns, certainly.
Well, first of all, I wonder how clear it is to our listeners that in many ways Pamela and Edward are criticizing the settlement from opposite sides. Pamela is saying she didn't like it that the Authors Guild sued Google in the first place because she thought Google's digitizing all of these books amounted to fair use, and she thinks there's a chance they could have won the lawsuit, which is not an unheard of position. I don't think it's a majority position, but certainly it was possible. And Pamela is also saying that the interests of academic authors weren't well enough represented here. There are many academic authors who are supporting the settlement and who love the settlement, partly because it will enable their out-of-print books to reach new audiences for the first time, while allowing them to retain control over how and when their books are used, and partly because, as researchers, it's such a valuable tool. This the caller who just called from Berkeley and said she uses the service struck a chord with me because I use the service constantly in the course of researching my next book, and it has saved me hundreds of hours that would have been spent trudging to libraries that, because I'm not a professor, I don't have ready access to anyway. It's just, there are a lot of technical questions that have been raised. Michael, you've made fun of some of the typos that exist in the database, and I've certainly encountered lots of those. When Google scans 17th century books where the S's look like F's, their computers often interpret those S's as F's. There are a lot of bugs that are going to have to be worked out. But when they're worked out, this resource is going to be so valuable to readers. I think if the settlement were not approved, it would be a a once-in-an-epic opportunity going down the drain.
Let me bring our callers back into this, and Danny from Oakland is next up. Morning, Danny.
Yeah, good morning, Michael. Great show. I don't know all the legalities of the Google plan in terms of whether once they do it, other companies will still be able to offer the same service for the same book and compete with Google if they want to. But I, as a musician, I know that this ultimately works very well for me and my music. It's available on multiple digital outlets. I get paid a small amount for songs or even entire CDs that are downloaded. And I now make half of my income from the music that's digitally sold and not actually physically sold as a product.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, I'm looking at an email here from a listener named Neil who says, Google appears to be making old books more readily available to all, just as Netflix's massive and easily accessed library movies makes offbeat movies easy to watch. And we heard James Glick extolling the fact that so much more availability will be out there as a result of this. What about the analogies, Tom Krasit, to, well, movie availability and music availability?
Well, it's interesting to think about. I mean, what's going to – I don't know how much we've covered this, but what's going to happen under the settlement is that this books rights registry group is being established. And it's a nonprofit not affiliated with Google who is going to manage sort of the task of finding – authors who have not claimed their books, as well as distributing the royalty payments through that. And then under the settlement, other companies are able to negotiate with the books rights registry for access to these works. In practice, we don't know exactly how that's going to work, but that's sort of how, you know, other companies could potentially get access to this library and make it available that widely.
Thomas explained that very nicely. I should emphasize, because I don't think it's completely clear, that there is potentially a lot of new money here flowing by way of the Google program. Google, you know, puts up little ads when it displays pages from your book. And under the settlement, rights holders are entitled to most of the revenue from those ads, also from revenue from institutional licenses and from revenue when Google sells individual access to books. And that will flow through this new book rights registry, which will be a great thing for the book business and long overdue.
And Professor Samuelson wanted a word in here. Pamela Samuelson?
So I think, you know, the difference between the Netflix and the musician who just called in and the settlement is that those things are based on voluntary, I agree to make this happen. And what's happening with the settlement is really coercion. And coercion, you can't get your book out of the Google settlement if you want to. The way that they've defined the word "remove," for example, in the settlement agreement, means that Google will just keep your book in a dark archive. And you know, maybe I don't want to have the book rights registry represent me. Maybe I want to have some other organization represent me. Maybe I don't want to have to fill out a whole bunch of paperwork in order to make my books available. I just think that there's a lot of coercion here, and it may work for you. Who voluntarily want to sign up for this, but for many of us, this agreement really seems very coercive.
Yeah,
but Pamela,
James Lick, go ahead.
Aren't you saying that that if Google just digitizes your book and allows people to search it, that that's fair use?
If it's making snippets available, yes, because I think that facilitates people being able then to link to go to a library where that book can be found, or link to a Amazon, where they can buy the book.
Any writer who feels the way you do, who wants Google not to be able to sell access to their books and not to show any pages, can simply tell Google that.
Well, they can tell Google that, James, if and only if they are the exclusive writer. Otherwise, they have no rights at all. And if they're prepared to take their publisher to arbitration over it. You know, you say that this would create new markets and generate lots of revenue. But that assumes that, you know, Google is the be-all and the end-all. Even Google itself already offers alternative partner programs with more favorable revenue terms than under the settlement for people who want to include their books. much less their competitors, which offer more favorable terms.
Didn't you say, Edward Hesburgh, that if Sergey Brin says there's no profit motive in this, he's lying? I don't know. I mean, I don't believe he said that.
If this is not the most profitable thing that Google could be investing their money in, then they're violating their duty, a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. If they can figure out a way to monetize their records of who's read which pages of which books on Google Book Search, it's their legal duty to do that. And none of that revenue from data mining, which Google itself says is likely to be one of the largest revenue streams, goes back to any of the rights holders. Similarly, if someone is searching within your book on Google Books, the rights holder, whoever that is deemed to be, which might not be the current rights holder, it's more likely to have shifted that to the publisher. But the rights holder might get some money. But if someone simply does a search on Google.com and is looking for a quotation from my book, and all the results they find are quotations from my book, I'll get none of that revenue. And that's where Google is making billions of dollars a year and will make billions more under this settlement.
We should mention here that we invited Google to send a representative. They declined. They gave us your number, James Glick, in fact, and said, why don't you invite him? I'm not certain why that was their tactic, but it was. I've also got an email here from a listener named Vazanth who says, Michael, you're an author. What's your position on this issue? Well, don't you know, as your public radio interlocutor, I sort of move around and don't take positions, as it were, at least not officially, even though sometimes it's hard not to. But I can say that I'm honestly, to be candid about it, kind of divided on this. I mean, the author and the scholar are divided on this inside of me. Let me find out what more of our listeners have to say or ask, and we'll go to Santa Cruz. Demetrios, good morning.
Good morning. There's greater societal issues here beyond the monetization and technical issues. One of them that was, you know, pretty funny and evident recently was Kindle pulling back, of all things, an Orwell novel because of rights issues. And I know in schools, for example, in elementary schools, they're all across the country nowadays, kids don't even get books to take home and help with the study. They get sort of like notes from the teacher. My concern is that are we headed towards like a Fahrenheit 451 scenario where books just completely disappear, and what is available, quote, in print is controlled by the state.
You know that libraries are well, in fact, Nicholas Baker made a major case out of this when he was living over here in Berkeley about libraries doing away, destroying books simply because they don't have the room for them. So we're going to have to find things online to at least accommodate all of the books that are out there.
Well, but for the foreseeable future, and maybe for the next 50 or 100 years, half of the world's population will not have internet access. What do we do? Do we relegate those people to being the permanently uneducated, underclassed, no access to civilization's history?
Tom Krasner.
So, well, I actually
wanted to go ahead.
I want to address that question about what if the books in the cloud go down. I think that's a really serious concern. If you remember, Google's Gmail has gone down a couple of times in the last couple of months. And imagine you're in need of a book to review for your class, and you go search for it on Google Books, and it's 404, Google Books not found. What are we going to do then? There's no redundancy if all the books in the world are on the servers and the public libraries have given away all their books because they've only now relying on Google's subscription. I think that's a really serious problem.
Well, it would be terrible if the libraries gave the digital copies of the only digital copy of all their books to Google and then burned their books. But that's not happening. Google's digital copy of the books is something new and something extra. Furthermore, Google is sharing, as you know, and it is giving back to each library another digital copy of all the books. So individual libraries, including the University of California libraries, that have been sharing their books with Google are going to have their own copy, not just of the digital versions of their own books, but of all the books. So there's a lot of redundancy built into the system.
But they can't make those available.
No, they can't. But you're talking about some cataclysm or outage. They can, and of course they can make them available within their own system under certain conditions.
James, excuse me, but I think Tom Krasny wanted a word in on this. Tom?
Well, I just think it's important to note that going forward, you know, in print, in copyright books will be available from a variety of sources, not just Google, not just libraries, but other digital partners as well. So, you know, what we're really talking about is a group of is a historic collection of books that were, I believe, it's anything published before January 5th, 2009.
Here's another listener who raises a salient question: for how long is the settlement valid? I'd be willing to put up with a bad settlement if this makes available all these books in 20 years, but if this extends copyrights for another life plus 75 years or worse, then it will be horrible. Are they building a modern public library of Alexandria, or will this all be a private asset forever, Tom?
Well, you know, I from what I understand, the and as I just mentioned, you know, going forward, the in-print, in-copyright books, you'll negotiate that directly with Google or Amazon or your publisher or wherever, and you can do, you know, a variety of different things that way. As far as extending the copyrights of the books that are in the out-of-print category, I don't know if I'm maybe the best person on this.
Well, you're listening to Forum, and this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, you're going to say something there, James Glick, please.
I can just answer that very simply. The settlement has no effect on copyright terms. It does not... The questioner does not have to be afraid. It doesn't make copyright terms any longer.
Good enough. And let's get Peter Warfield on with us from the world of the libraries. Hi, Peter.
Hi, it's Peter Warfield from Library Users Association. Very interesting. Thank you for the program. I'm very concerned about the impact on libraries, on authorship, and on the appreciation of books. Something somebody said just as a point of information, interlibrary loan is available from even the smallest library if they offer the service. And you don't need to be near a university library to have access to the many millions of titles that are available through WorldCat. Snippets, I think, are great. I found my own name in a book search that I hadn't heard about, and then I naturally got the book from a library. But the whole book really concerns me, all the issues that have been talked about, monopoly, privacy for people who are looking. Also, there's a question of what are they going to select? How are they going to index it? Will things drop off the earth, and will Google kind of become a monopoly that is the only place you can find anything? And if they've dropped it or called it the Great White Wall instead of the whale, it's a joke, but there are smaller, less obvious errors that very few people would notice, but certainly scholars or people looking up a particular subject.
Well, again, that seems to be the major concern, James Glick, monopolization.
But this is something extra. On the one hand, the caller is saying that he can already get these books through interlibrary loan, and I do that, and it's true, and nothing about this Google Books program or the settlement is going to make it more difficult to get those books through interlibrary loan. On the contrary, it'll be easier to find the books you need and then order them.
Another question here, is the Library of Congress involved at all in this? Do we know, Tom Krasny, about the Library of Congress's involvement?
They're not, as far as I know. And that's come up at some other things that I've been a part of, and some people are you know, just as worried about giving the Library of Congress control over some of these things as they are Google. So I don't know if anybody else...
The National Writers Union, as part of our ongoing lobbying work to get the Orphan Works problem addressed, has specifically raised the suggestion that if we are going to, and I think we should, fund and create a national digital library, that the Library of Congress is a much more appropriate repository than is a private company like Google. You know, writers want to see their works out there, whether it's, you know, academic writers like Professor Samuelson, who may not be interested in money, or the Writers Union members who are struggling to make a living from their writing. We want our works to be available. But when we create a public facility like a digital library, we don't normally say we want a public facility, so we're going to conscript construction workers to build it without pay. This settlement would build this digital library for Google's profit at the expense of a massive takeaway of the fruits of lifetimes of writers' labors.
Here's a listener named David who says the American Society of Media Photographers, joined by the Graphic Artists Guild, the Picture Archive Council of America, the North American Nature Photography Association, and several prominent individual photographers, has filed documents in opposition to the proposed settlement. ASMP General Counsel Victor Perlman said, quote, "The vast majority of photographers and graphic artists whose works have been and continue to be digitized by Google without authorization would neither receive compensation for past infringement nor any benefit going forward." Well, Professor Samuelson.
I think that's right.
And Peter Glick, James Glick, excuse me.
No, I'm afraid that's just confusion. They're mistaken. Photographers are not part of the settlement in any way. They do not give up any rights in the settlement. Google does not have the right to display any of their photographs. And if you go to Google Book Search now, you can see the result of that, which is pages of books that happen to have photographs on them have the photographs blacked out, so you can't see them.
We'll try to get one additional caller in here from Hercules. David, you're on.
Yeah. How are they going to guarantee access to everyone? For instance, let's say I wrote a book on Tiananmen Square with a whole bunch of photographs in it also. The Chinese government is not going to let that information get in. They're already stopping it. And then Google and Yahoo and all these other places have already had problems with the veracity of their statement.
Yeah. What do you think, Tom Krasny?
Well, I mean, if you live in China, yeah, you may not be able to get access to that book, but you certainly will anywhere else in the world where governments don't put that kind of control on information.
And that
it's worth mentioning, though, that it's only U.S. Institutions that will be able to get the kind of access to books that that the settlement brings about. The copyright issues in other countries are not dealt with by the settlement.
Well,
That's a very good point. It's only in the U.S., and Europe is quite envious and scrambling to catch up.
That is going to have to be the final word because we're out of time. I hope you brought light to this. It's complicated. It's labyrinthine. But I want to thank all our guests for helping bring the light. James Glick again with us from New York, member of the Board of Directors of the Authors Guild, and Pamela Samuelson, professor at UC Berkeley School of Law, Tom Krasit, staff writer for CNET.com, and Edward Hasbrook, with co-chair of the books division for the National Writers Union. We thank all of you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.